You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Buongiorno, jaunty joy-seekers jamming for jubilance and jaw-dropping journeys while wearing jodhpurs. This is Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's show is episode 227, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your foremost Faustian foursome foraging for formidable forensic fodder.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. Dana, you seem like, yeah, we
are. I was like, yeah, we do, like, yeah, I do forage do for, yeah. Yeah, Faustian. I was like, yeah, I'm feeling this. This seems accurate.
I would sell my soul to the devil for more knowledge and power. All right, we're going to start the show with our very special Purple Tier patrons on Patreon. They get to submit some questions or trivia, and I got a good one. Chuck here has tailor-made a trivia question for each of us.
Oh, gosh.
I like it. Bespoke.
Based on your interests, and also he also made fake prizes. Chris, you're in the spotlight now. This is your question.
Here we go.
For one serving of delicious Japanese curry, which is the prize, name the two non-conventional items supposedly played as percussion instruments on the title track to Fleetwood Mac's Tusk.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I know that Lindsey Buckingham was banging on Kleenex boxes.
Ding, 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 ding. That's one.
Okay.
My goodness.
And gee, what would the other non-conventional percussion item be? The wall of his bathroom.
Maybe. But Chuck here says a lamb chop.
A lamb chop. I did not know a lamb chop.
A meaty sound.
Like a wet.
Like a wet, slappy kind of sound, I guess.
wet and slappy.
So much of Lindsey Buckingham's tracks on Tusk, it's like, yeah, well, Mick Fleetwood is the drummer, right? But it's like a lot of Lindsey's tracks, he tracked all the tracks like alone in his house using sort of oddball stuff like that.
Oh. Yeah.
Foley artists.
You too can make a wildly crazy follow-up to your successful album with just these household items.
Yeah. Well, okay, Colin, you're next. Chuck has a question for you. And he says, though it has a population of fewer than 5,000 people, the town of Donora, D-O-N-O-R-A, Donora, Pennsylvania, is the hometown of two of the greatest baseball players of all time. Name them both and earn yourself a 1 pound candy corn. Name only one and you earn a 2 pound candy corn.
My gosh. All right. Donora.
The thing is, I know your knowledge of baseball is not nearly as good as your basketball.
Certainly not. And other, maybe some more obscure sports too. But okay, I mean, this, I'm just going to have to go for household names here. All right.
Okay.
Donora, Pennsylvania. I don't know. I'll say Joe DiMaggio and Cal Ripken Sr. Cal Ripken Jr.
Both wrong. Stan Musial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Ken Griffey Jr.
Oh, okay. Well,
Junior. You got half a point for Junior. So you got 3 pounds of candy corn.
That's a good one. Yeah. I'm sure that if you go to Donora, Pennsylvania, they are extremely proud of that.
All right. Dana, you're next. Okay. Chuck asks you for a fermented Scandinavian candy. That's your prize.
Yeah.
In what year did the very first Lifetime movie come out? Multiple choice.
Okay, good.
1990, mm-hmm. 1993, or 1996?
Oh, Chuck, this is a good question. I don't want the candy, so I feel like I win either way. So that's good. 96 feels late. I'll say 93.
It is 1990.
Okay.
Right in the start of the decade. And the movie is Memories of Murder. Memories yes.
that's,
of
that's the perfect start wow. to their
really I mean they just right out of the gate they just had it yeah, yeah.
Those are great questions, Chuck. I want to say
yeah so far yeah. very good
yeah yeah.
So Chuck has a question for me. For a delightful Dutch crunch, my favorite bread, which two Disney films are set in Hawaii?
Okay,
I already saw the answer, and I have a gripe with one of the answers.
Animated Disney, because there animated. Are...
It's animated Disney films?
Animated
okay, so Disney. Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah. Correct.
We're sitting in Hawaii.
It's not Moana. That's just the Pacific Islands.
Right, somewhere. Right.
So yeah. In his answer, he said Moana. Moana happens in Polynesia, which includes Hawaii, but they never stated that it was Hawaii.
It's probably right. not Hawaii.
They made a conscious decision of focusing on Polynesia in general. Mm-hmm. So, but these are excellent tailor-made questions for us. Thank you so much, Chuck, for these questions and also for your very personalized Fantastic. Fake prizes. Well, let's continue yeah. the trivia party. Let's jump into our first, well, now second trivia yeah. segment. Pop quiz, hot shot. So I have here a random Trivial Pursuit card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers at the ready. Let's answer some questions. Here we go. Blue Wedge for geography. Which South American country lays claim to the invention of the Panama hat?
Oh.
Colin.
We've had this one so many times. It's not Panama.
Right.
I want to say it's Ecuador.
Correct! You yeah. heard. All Ecuador. Right. Pink Wedge for pop culture. Huh. What Irish actor wears a certain pair of boxers when starting a new film because they're covered in lucky shamrocks?
Huh.
Huh. Irish actor.
Colin.
Colin Farrell?
Yes!
Woo!
Oh my gosh.
Wow. How did you know that?
I was just first Irish actor that came to my mind. That was honestly, yeah.
Yellow Wedge for history. Who was fatally wounded in 1968 in Memphis on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, which is now preserved as a civil rights museum? Yeah. Chris.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Correct. Mm-hmm. All right. Purple Wedge. What was once the catchy slogan of the National Enquirer?
Oh.
This is like the tabloid.
Celebrity gossip. Celebrity. And yeah.
No story is too tenuous to not.
Print. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Colin, what's your guess?
I believe I remember from the commercials, it's Inquiring Minds Want to Know.
Yes! Oh,
yes! Wow. Yes, nice. Yes, yes. That is the... Mm-hmm.
E-N. Enquiring.
Yeah. Yes, Enquiring yeah. Minds Enquiring. Want to Know.
Made it yeah. sound TM. Made it sound yeah. so intellectual.
I know. It yeah. does. But it's like every story is like this person's pregnant and it's like they had a burrito at lunch, but they're definitely pregnant.
All right, Green Wedge, which prestigious school of oceanography is located near San Diego? Colin.
Is that Scripps?
Yes! Oh. How do you know this? Wow!
You know, wow. I mean, I grew up in Southern California,
That's
you know.
That's good. My mind went to like SeaWorld as like Shamu U or something like that.
I've got some whales in the family too, so you know, it's, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Scripps Institution of Oceanography in San Diego. Yeah, whales vagina. Yeah.
What?
Just watch Anchorman?
Okay.
Yeah. Important context there. Yes.
Yeah, right.
People called it San Diego, which means whales vagina. Oh, okay. I thought it meant Saint Diego. okay. Last question, Orange Wedge, Sports and Leisure. Which celebration dance by Victor Cruz got him an invitation to appear on Dancing with the Stars, which he respectfully declined?
Huh.
Which celebration dance?
It was, yeah, which one was it?
This is like a Sports End Zone dance?
I mean, do you remember that this was a few years ago? There was just a wave, like before the NFL kind of, you know, clamped down on the fun of there was a lot of guys doing the very high profile signature moves and, you know, cashing in and marketing it. I mean, good for them.
So but, yeah. I'm guessing we can eliminate. This is not the guy who pretended to poop the football.
No, I don't think so.
Get you on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. Same, if you will, though.
It is salsa.
What?
Okay. Oh, he just did a little salsa dance.
Salsa dance.
That's right. I do remember that now.
All right. Good job, Brains. This week, our topic is inspired by the title of an upcoming Pixar movie about a girl who turns into a red panda, which is one of my top five animals. Favorite animals of all time. And the movie is called Turning Red. And I know we actually love our past episodes about colors. So this week, we're rolling out the red carpet and we're going to celebrate all things red.
All right, I'll get us started. I made a quiz and it is called Red Stuff. It's just stuff I thought of or found that was red related, and I thought had some interesting trivia. So we'll do it Barnyard Buzzers style.
All right.
And we'll get started right now. First question. Which planet in our solar system is nicknamed the Red Planet? Everybody.
Mars.
That's right.
I was so scared that it was going to be something else.
And Jupiter. Yes, Mars. Do you know what gives it the red tinge?
Oh, I think it's rust.
Like iron oxide,
Yeah. Yes. All right, next question. The ruby, a red gemstone, is the birthstone for which typically hot weather month?
Oh, geez.
There's one out of three.
I think that's my brother's birthstone, so it would be July.
July. If I'm right. Yes.
Is that it? Okay,
yes. Great. There's another red birthstone.
I know. It's garnet.
The garnet. What month is that?
January.
Ooh. January. Nice.
It's also one of those just freebie trivia things to memorize, right? You know
it
what I mean? Like,
up.
It's just, yeah, it, you just, you're like, ah, this
it's
again.
Such a kick in the stomach. You're like, there's only 12 of them. Why don't I know these?
Yes, exactly.
Because who cares? That's why. Because who cares?
I know.
Who cares, brain?
Who cares, brain?
Okay. The Red Sea is an inlet of which ocean? The Red Sea. Karen.
Indian Ocean.
Yes, Karen. Yes, nice, yes it nice. Is. Okay. Which red-colored bird is the most common state bird in the United States? Karen.
The cardinal.
Yes, the cardinal. Oh. The cardinal. Seven states have that as their state bird.
Which, wait, Chris, what were you going to guess?
I was going to say Robin, but I mean, yours makes more sense.
I just think of like a lot of sports teams.
Is a lot of like Midwestern states, Dan?
A lot of Midwestern. Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Ohio, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina.
Whoa.
That's the bird.
Yeah, South Midwest. Okay. All right. Yeah. Interesting. That's a good one.
What is the state bird of California? Do we know?
It's the quail.
Oh, the condor.
The quail, right?
The quail?
Isn't it the California quail? It could be the condor. Ooh, oh my God.
I don't think that's our state bird. I don't think that's our
it's
state bird.
It's just like the endangered bird, the California
quail. Right. It just happened to, they name it after.
Like it is. Quail. It's the California quail. It's so cute. It has a little thing on its head.
Little hat. Yeah. I like it. Okay. Which commonly red-colored insect emits foul-smelling yellow blood from its leg joints when it's startled?
Cool.
Whoa.
There's a little. Oh. Colin.
A stink bug? I mean, is it just as simple as that? I don't know.
It's a red colored insect.
Oh.
Karen. Oh.
Ladybug.
Ladybug. Oh. Ladybug's blood is yellow and it's stinky and it's toxic to many of its predators, like birds and small mammals. they are stinky. Ladybugs are stinky. I Googled it and people were like, how do you get rid of ladybug stink? And I was like, huh, I have no idea
what smell that is.
What? All right. There are U.S. presidents on the penny, the nickel, the dime, the quarter, and the half dollar coins. So on those five coins,
yeah,
there are. Okay. Can you tell me which coins have presidents who are redheads?
No.
Oh my gosh.
Wait, and there are three of those presidents, coins have redheads on it.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay, sure. All right. I'm going to take a guess at this. I'm going to take a stab at this. Ready?
Okay.
Here we go. The half dollar, the quarter, and the nickel.
Yes.
Oh,
who are they?
Chris.
So I was thinking Jefferson, Washington. I felt like they were redheads, and then Kennedy.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh.
There we go.
I guess Washington, you know, it's just like you picture him as just white haired, but I mean, yeah.
if you look at naked pictures of them, it becomes much more clear, you know? So,
heyo.
Yeah, it's true. And just to like clear it out, the penny has Lincoln and his hair was black, and the dime has Franklin Roosevelt and he has brown hair. Sticking with redheads, Christina Hendricks, Gillian Anderson, Nicole Kidman, and Sophie Turner. All seen with red hair. Only one is an actual natural redhead.
Oh,
which is
Chris. Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman is the only natural redhead. Some other famous redheads who are not actually born redheads are Lucille Ball, we've talked about, Anne Margaret, David Bowie, Tori Amos. I was looking at a list of iconic redheads, and they were so high on the list, but they're not actually redheads.
Tori Amos is not a redhead?
No.
But that's like so, that's her brand.
It is her brand.
Exactly, yes.
She was pretty high on the list of iconic redheads. all right, and then we'll close it out with some idioms. Chris has been doing some idiom quizzes, and then I was like, there's so many idioms with red. I have to do a few. I won't totally bite his quiz, but I'll like staple it on to the end of my red stuff quiz.
It's a writer.
Yeah. Here we go. All right. This idiom means to go out into a city or town and have an enjoyable time visiting various establishments.
I don't know.
I heard a horse. Colin?
You paint the town red.
That's right. How about a very exciting or notable day?
Oh,
Chris.
I would give it to Karen. She knows the English language idiom.
Okay, yes, Karen. I like it.
Struggle bus. A red letter day.
That's right.
That's
because my partner says it all the time.
Oh, really?
In the beginning, I confuse it with scarlet letter, and I was like, that doesn't sound like it's a good...
Like it's a day of shame.
Yeah.
That's also, frankly, why I like letting Karen guess, because, like, if, you know, I want you to get it right, Karen, but if you get it wrong, it's always funny, you know? So it's like, oh, scarlet letter day. It's like, oh, that's great.
It's all water under the house. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's all,
A sign or signal indicating potential, incipient, or imminent danger or trouble. Chris.
Red flag.
Oh.
One of the favorite terms of the internet. It's just red flags.
favorite emoji.
Yeah. How about something irrelevant that diverts attention away from the main problem or issue?
Oh.
Colin.
Are you looking for a red herring there?
Yes. Red herring. Mm-hmm. Last one. To fall into a state of extreme anger, excitement, or competitive arousal. Chris.
Arousal.
To see red,
yes.
Mm.
Good job, guys.
That's a good one.
That was good. See, I'm glad we did the idioms.
Yeah, me too.
My turn. So for this episode about red, I was thinking about red foods. Specifically the flavor red. You know what I'm talking about, right?
You see
them in like gummy bears, Starbursts, sodas, like it's the flavor
donut
red.
Fillings.
So in most cases, the red flavor is supposed to be cherry. But why doesn't it actually taste like cherries? And who decided that this is what cherries taste like? Because they taste nothing like the actual, you know, cherries on the stems that we eat. This goes back to the big initial boom of creating synthetic flavors, which was around like mid-1800s. Chemists and scientists were like obsessed with figuring out how to mix and match chemicals they already had so that they could come up with like imitation food flavors, specifically fruit, right? These days, scientists can just isolate the compounds and they can almost like backwards engineer. But, you know, back then they didn't really have the equipment or sophisticated ways to like properly.
A lot of trial and error.
Yes, exactly. So they can only go by their experience and their own interpretation of what fruits tasted like at that time. At that time, while working with a limited library of available like flavor compounds and chemicals. So we're talking like 19th century here. So foods and tastes change and evolve. Chris, you talked about Necco wafers. There was like violet flavored things, clove. They're almost like a snapshot of tastes from that time period. For example, the artificial grape flavor was modeled after the Concord grape and not like the green grapes we eat these days. And then, of course, there's the artificial banana flavor. We love Laffy Taffys, right?
It's its own thing. It's its own flavor.
However, did you know that, you know, we might think, man, that fake banana flavor is like just so far from an actual banana that we eat. That fake banana flavor was actually based on a banana variety that tasted like that.
Whoa.
We've just never had that kind of banana before because it died out, or it almost died out in the 1950s. So there was a banana variety that tasted kind of similar to the fake banana flavor.
Interesting.
We've just diverged, right? We went down a different path.
So what about the artificial cherry flavor, our famous red flavor? People back then associated cherry flavor with cherry liqueurs more so than fresh cherries. So cherry liqueurs, they're made out of like whole cherries, mashed up, pit and all, sometimes stems, steeped in alcohol and sugar. So the resulting flavor has like a almond flavor, like an almond scent because of the cherry pits. The cherry pits have like compounds that get released when they're made into liqueurs. Yeah. That's the flavor that the flavor chemists, they're like, this is cherry to us, right? Because we're used to the liqueurs. So this was what American flavor chemists at the time associated cherries with. If you go to different parts of the world, their generic red cherry flavor tastes different because the liqueur is kind of like what the American chemists were really into. So cherry liqueurs, let's talk about a little bit of cherry liqueurs. What are some examples of cherry alcohol? There's crème de cerise from France. And then kirsch, right, from Black Forest Cakes.
Kirsch from Germany.
And famously, we have the maraschino liqueur from Croatia. So, which brings us to the ultimate red flavor food, the cocktail cherry, or the maraschino cherry.
Oh
man,
it can't get any more red. It's glowing.
Yes,
you see it on an ice cream sundae. Old cookbooks, they have like hams that they put cocktail cherry. All around.
Pineapple.
And when you move it off the slice of ham, there's the little red ring where it was.
Shirley Temple
fruit cocktail.
But once upon a time, the maraschino cherries were actually stored in maraschino alcohol. But in today's time of mass production, they're first completely bleached in chemicals. So they're actually like white.
That makes sense.
And then they get stored in a liquid that's made up of water, sugar, almond extract, and red number 40. And that'll be important later. So the contents of the liquid is important because I want to tell you a quick story, and it is so wild. So in a previous episode of Good Job Brain, long ago, we talked about like I think Colin, you brought up a news item where beekeepers were noticing that their bees were mysteriously making blue honey.
That was me.
Oh, it was your news item.
Oh yeah. They were near an M&M's factory, and they were sucking up all the sugar off the discarded M&M's. And they were pooping out blue honey.
Yes, yes. they were eating like the colored candy shells, and then the dye affected their honey and it turned mm-hmm. blue, which made the actual commercial honey like unsellable.
Yeah.
Well, guess what, you guys? Back in 2010 in Brooklyn, New York, beekeepers were seeing red honey showing up their hives. They could literally see the bees in their bellies, like bright red. People figured out that the bees were visiting the nearby Dell's Maraschino Cherry Factory.
Yes.
Because they were able to test the bees, and turns out they tested positive for red dye number 40.
They tested positive for maraschino.
The bees were snacking on the syrup, you know, when the vats of syrups are being moved around or kind of left outside. And Arthur Mandela, the owner of Dell's Maraschino Cherry, worked with the Beekeeper Association and agreed to, like, you know, have better process and seal the vats so this can stop happening. Now, this is where, like, it goes from a cute bee story to, like, a Netflix original limited series. So, a year before this bee incident happened, the DA office and investigators got a tip that Arthur Mandela, the owner of the Maraschino Cherry Factory, was illegally running a secret marijuana grow operation underneath the cherry factory. But the investigators, they didn't have enough evidence to procure like a search warrant.
Okay. They sent in bees with wires.
Exactly. They got some bees, tipped them off.
They noticed the bees were developing a real craving for Flamin' Hot Cheetos, but
they went back to the M&M factory.
So thanks to the bees and their surprise red honey, the investigators now, they have a legitimate reason to search the building under suspicions of illegal syrup dumping. Okay. And sure enough, they uncovered a secret 2,500 square feet grow operation underneath the building.
Oh my goodness.
All thanks to the bee and the maraschino syrup.
This is why you should run honey. A clean syrup factory. I'm telling you. Look, all jokes aside, like, it's how many like criminal operation stories, right? I mean, it's like, it's not the actual criminal operation that trips them up. It's some other thing, tangential.
This famously, our friend Maddie, friend of the show Maddie, when she was in kindergarten, went to kindergarten and learned about bees and raised her hand and said that she heard on, quote, the podcast that that the bees were eating M&Ms and making blue honey.
Yeah.
Now they eat maraschino syrup and they're making red honey.
Yeah.
It sounds tasty. I guess it's just red dye, though.
It sounds like fun, but it also is just sort of like, you can't like have an operation and like force bees to eat garbage. It's like, that sounds the bees are already like endangered enough, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, it would be weird to start making them eat trash so you can get weird colored honey out of it when you just put food dye in your honey. Skip you get the middleman.
Fun essences of things. You're like
Dorito honey.
Yeah. Chili honey. Yeah, Dorito honey.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hi, my name's Avalon. Did you know that pandas poop 100 times a day? You're listening to Good Job Brain. Bye.
And we're back. And this week we're seeing red.
All right. Well, apologies because, okay, so Karen Karen sends around the email about, okay, everybody, the topic for this episode is going to be red. And what instantly popped into my mind is one of the funniest things I ever saw on television, which was the 56th annual Grammy Awards. On January 26, 2014, at the end of the show, they do the award for the album of the year, right? The big last one. Now, the favorite in that year was Taylor Swift's album, Red. And so the presenter is on stage and they open up the envelope and they have the individual cameras on all the nominees in the audience for like their individual reactions at the same time. The presenter goes, and the winner is Red. And so much happens in that moment. Taylor, you see Taylor Swift and all, if you go back and watch the video, Taylor Swift and all the people around her, like her entourage, start fist pumping and they're like, and they're ready to like stand up and go on stage. But then, and then the presenter goes, and Access Memories by Daft Punk. But you know, it was considered to be a big upset. And Taylor Swift was pretty upset. Like you see, like they're just like, oh, you know, the whole faces fall, you know,
space of a second.
And it's just a second. And of Access Memories. It's like, oh, she was convinced she was going to win. You know what I mean? And so it was like, that's why that just sort of initial kind of reaction. But it got me thinking, wouldn't it be fun to talk about other moments like that at the Grammys, other Grammy upsets, the upset Ooh. Grammys. So again, I'm sorry, like that's the free association that my brain made. And then I started looking at it. I'm like, this is a really good quiz. Okay. It doesn't have anything to do with the topic except for that one little thing I just said. But I think you're going to enjoy this 10 question write down quiz about Grammy upsets. So here,
red moments, if you will.
Yeah. Yes. Red moments.
Some moments when maybe some folks at the Grammys were seeing red. So a little spiel first. This is very interesting because I start looking at this. The Beatles, interestingly, did not win a lot of Grammy awards as a group. Mm. You would think that, oh, yeah, the Beatles, they just crushed the Grammys every year. Nope. They got Best Performance by a Vocal Group in 1965. They got Best New Artist, 1965.
Wow.
And in 1968, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band won Best Contemporary Album and Album of the Year. And that was it for the full band, the Beatles. Four Grammys. There are three more Grammy Awards that are credited to the Beatles as a group, and they are from 1997 for the Beatles Anthology. But during that original run with the complete band, they only had four. And in many cases, they got nominated but lost in what were considered, you know, big upsets at the time. A lot of these upsets, by the way, are going to be old people music winning over the young people music at the time, which probably tells you about who was voting, right?
Right.
So in 1967, the Beatles album Revolver lost Album of the Year to a retrospective collection from this singer who had won Album of the Year the previous year for an album titled September of My Years. Name the singer.
He won
Album of the Year in 66 for an album called September of My Years, and then won Album of the Year again with what was essentially a greatest hits collection, beating Beatles Revolver. Well, September of My Years is supposed to be the clue here that points you to a certain person.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, answers up. Colin says Frank Sinatra. Dana says Frank Sinatra. And Karen says Hank Williams. It is Frank Sinatra. Yes. Please keep your own score. I can't be bothered.
Okay.
Okay, question number two. In an upset over Beyonce, this singer's album, Morning Phase, won Album of the Year in 2015. In an upset over Beyonce, this singer's album, Morning Phase,
Beyonce.
I know. I just enjoy saying it that way. Yeah.
That's fine. Yeah.
2015.
This singer's album, Morning Phase, won Album of the Year in 2015.
Do you know which Beyonce album it was?
It was Beyonce.
Beyonce's
album. Beyonce. Okay, let's see some answers. Let's see the best you got. Karen says Sam Smith.
That's a great guess. Dana mine is a bad guess.
Taylor Swift. And Colin has jotted down Ed Sheeran.
That's also a really good guess.
It is none of those. It is Beck. Beck.
Oh, that's right.
Beck's Morning Fave.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Leader, guys.
Yes. I did not know he had another album recently.
Look at that. Look at that. Yeah. Question three. Jazz bassist Esperanza Spalding won the Grammy for Best New Artist in 2011. And she won that award over Drake, Florence and the Machine, Mumford and Sons, and this Canadian singer.
Okay.
So I'll say it again. Jazz bassist Esperanza Spalding won Best New Artist in 2011, winning that Grammy over Drake, Florence and the Machine, Mumford and Sons, and this Canadian singer. Okay, answer's up. Okay, so Dana says Justin Bieber. Colin says Justin Bieber. Karen says Michael Bublé. It is Justin Bieber.
How am I failing this quiz?
Lots of 12-year-olds were big, big mad.
Really mad.
Real so mad.
Big mad.
Yeah.
Now, in 2008, the debate was all about whether Album of the Year would go to Amy Winehouse with Back to Black or Kanye West with Graduation. Instead, it went to an album of Joni Mitchell covers by this jazz legend. So I'll read it again. In 2008, the debate was all about whether Album of the Year would go to Amy Winehouse with Back to Black or Kanye West for Graduation. Instead, it went to an album of Joni Mitchell covers by this jazz legend.
Will you give us any? Is this a singer, instrumentalist?
I'll say it's primarily considered to be an instrumentalist.
All right.
Give me something. Think of, write down a jazz person, jazz instrumentalist. Karen says Diana Krall. Dana says Herbie Hancock. And Colin should show me whatever it is.
I'll second Herbie Hancock.
Colin is going to ride on Dana's previously announced answer of Herbie Hancock.
If it's correct, I'll take 3/4 of a point.
I think this is 1/4 of a point.
Dana is correct. It is Herbie Hancock.
I think so. No point, but an asterisk.
If it came down to a tie between Colin and Karen, then Colin would get the nod in that case.
So far,
right. Okay. Moving right along. Question number five. In 1989, the Grammy Awards debuted the category Best Hard Rock / Metal Performance. Metallica was widely expected to win for their album And Justice for All, but they lost to this British band named after an 18th century English agriculturist.
I got it. 100%.
In 1989, the Grammy Awards debuted the category Best Hard Rock / Metal Performance. Metallica was widely expected to win for its album And Justice for All, but lost to this British band named after an 18th century English agriculturalist. Okay. Answers up. So Karen says Jethro Tull. Colin says Jethro Tull. And Dana.
Eventually.
Getting her own back here. Belatedly. As put, Jethro Tull.
I'll take my asterisk for
That's a fair swap. It's like trading pieces on the chessboard, right, Dana? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, you're all wrong. That's what you get for copying. No, I was right. Jethro Tull. Yes. I don't know how you score yourselves. This is violating, if not the letter, the spirit of Good Job, Brandt. You all need to take a look inside yourselves, and you need to. I want you to write down what you think.
I mean,
all right. Well, I guess there's nothing else to do but move on. Okay. Question number six. In 2011, Katy Perry's Teenage Dream, Eminem's Recovery, Lady Antebellum's Need You Now, and perhaps most notably, Lady Gaga's The Fame Monster lost Album of the Year to this Canadian indie rock band.
Oh.
In 2011, Katy Perry's Teenage Dream, Eminem's Recovery, Lady Antebellum's Need You Now, and perhaps most notably, Lady Gaga's The Fame Monster lost album of the year to this Canadian indie rock band.
Ooh.
This is one of those, like, name a Canadian indie rock band questions.
Okay, Dana and Colin have to show their answers.
I'm ready.
All right, I'm ready too.
All right, everybody has an answer. Everybody can show it at the same time. Karen says Arcade Fire. Dana says The New Pornographers. Colin says Arcade Fire. It is Arcade Fire. No, question seven. This indie folk band won Best New Artist in 2012 over Nicki Minaj and the band Perry. A lot of people think this band is a person, so let me clear it up. Justin Vernon is the name of the guy. The band's name is this. Question number seven. This indie folk band won Best New Artist in 2012 over Nicki Minaj and the band Perry. A lot of people think this band is a person, so let me clear it up. Justin Vernon is the guy, and the band's name is this. Okay, Dana wrote down something. Karen wrote down something. Colin is shaking his head. Colin, what did you write?
No, I put Michael Bublé.
Michael Bublé.
But no.
Karen and Dana have put Bon Iver. Yes. Bon Iver. Yes. Bon Iver is the name of a band. It is not a guy named Bon Iver.
I remember people thought he was called Bonnie Bear, or the band was called Bonnie Bear. Like, who's Bonnie Bear?
Question eight. In 2005, album of the year nominees included Usher's Confessions, Kanye West's The College Dropout, Green Day's American Idiot, and Alicia Keys' The Diary of Alicia Keys. None of them won. Instead, it went to a collaborations / duets album by a recently deceased legendary artist. Name the artist, and for a bonus point, name the album. In 2005, album of the year nominees included Usher's Confessions, Kanye West's The College Dropout, Green Day's American Idiot, and Alicia Keys' The Diary of Alicia Keys. None of them won. Instead, it went to a collaborations / duets album by a recently deceased legendary artist. Name the artist. For a bonus point, name the album. And when I say recently deceased, I mean they had died recently at that time, not like now.
So don't
tell me somebody about somebody who died just now. Ago. Somebody who passed away close to 2005. Karen and Dana have both actually written down the same thing, which is Tony Bennett duets. He's very much alive Tony Bennett.
Yeah, yes.
Right. Yeah. I really thought he died recently.
I know he has like Alzheimer's, but he has in fact
released a second album of duets with Lady Gaga.
Yes.
And Colin put Johnny Cash. What was the name of the album you put down, Colin?
American Songs?
Johnny Cash, American Songs. Big fat no to everybody. It is Ray Charles. Genius Loves Company.
Wow. Coffee houses
everywhere.
They sold it in Starbucks. That's right. Absolutely. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Two more questions. Question nine. 1992 was widely assumed that the Best Rock Song Grammy would go to Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. It instead went to this slowed down acoustic version of a 1970s rock hit. Name the name of the song.
Oh, interesting.
1992. It was widely assumed the Best Rock Song Grammy would go to Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit. It did not. It instead went to a slowed down. Was it rock? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's rock. It's slow rock. It's maybe rock ballad. Slowed down acoustic version of a 1970s rock song.
1970s rock songs.
1992. The singer was the same, but technically the band that performed it in the 70s was not the... It was like the band did it in the 70s, and then this was the singer of that band. It was credited to the singer in 92. Slowed down. Now, to be fair, this is not an obscure song. It's a big hit. It was really more of an upset because Again, old people music winning over the fresh, new young people music. And also, you know, because it was like a slowed down, almost adult contemporary, easy listening versus Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit, which really fell into the rock category. You are gonna kick yourself.
Man, I know. Yourself. It's like, so many hints.
Your song. This song in 92 was like, you could not escape this thing on the radio.
Interesting.
Could not escape it. Okay. I don't know. Colin writes, love hurts. Dana says, Sweet Jane. Karen says, Last Kiss. The song.
They all sound like
that one best rock song in 1992 was the slowed down version of Layla by Eric Clapton.
Oh, of course. No. From the Unplugged, right? Yeah, from
Eric Clapton. MTV Unplugged. I even said acoustic. I didn't say Unplugged, but I did say acoustic. Yes.
Yeah.
So
that was fair. That was good. Yeah.
So let me just check in with you all, because you've been keeping score for yourselves. Why don't you weigh in with your current standings right now as we head into question 10?
Four with a anywhere between an asterisk and some percentage of a point.
Okay.
Three. Four with an asterisk.
So I'm going to tell you something very exciting right now. It is anybody's game. Right now, it is like anybody's game. I mean, you're only separated by 1 point. So, I mean, it would have been anybody's game, but it's really anybody's game, because question number 10, you have an opportunity to score 4 points.
Oh,
whoa.
So question number 10, have you ever heard of the song Winchester Cathedral by the New Vaudeville Band? Have any of you ever heard of this song?
No.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't think so. It was a really weird throwback lo-fi pseudo vaudeville novelty song from the 60s. It came out in the late 60s, but it was supposed to just sound like an old vaudeville song where the guy sounds like he's singing through a megaphone. In fact, okay, why even right. describe it? I have a clip right here that you can simply listen to what this song sounded like. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Let's listen.
Winchester Cathedral. You're bringing me down. You stood and you watched out. My baby left town.
Despite this song not even being anywhere near close to a rock and roll song by the standards of the day or today, it won Best Contemporary Rock and Roll Recording in 1967.
No way!
In 1967. Best rock and roll song. And it beat out, amongst others, I think, it beat out what are now 4 absolutely iconic rock songs of the era. So for 1 point each, I want you to name the songs. A Beatles song about a woman who picks stuff up off the ground. B, the Mamas and the Papas song about an untrustworthy day. C, a Monkees song about a mode of transportation. And D, a Beach Boys song, which was, at the time, the most expensive song ever recorded.
Huh.
I'll give you those 4 again so you can think about it. We'll make sure that everybody gets an answer for these. A Beatles song about a woman who picks things up off the ground. B, a Mamas and Papas song about an untrustworthy day. C, a Monkees song about a mode of transportation. And D, a Beach Boys song, which was, at the time, the most expensive song ever recorded.
Okay.
You know, people say my musical tastes are sort of unique or odd. This is not true. My musical tastes are absolutely in the mainstream.
1967.
For the year 1967. Exactly. Thank you.
All right.
I only know one Monkey song.
I only know the Shrek song. Right.
I don't want any asterisks on this one. You know what I mean?
No,
I want this.
Yeah,
I want this to be a nice clean win. You're right. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, we want to see a nice clean win for Colin here. Just bring it across the line.
Okay. I want everybody to kind of hold it up, and we're, first of all, I want to see if anybody aced it, right?
Oh, that was the song. That was a Guitar Hero. Okay,
not everybody. There is nobody who has nailed this. So let's look at the first one. So for the Beatles song, Karen says Penny Lane. Dana says what?
Eleanor Rigby.
Eleanor Rigby, and Colin says Eleanor Rigby. Yes, it is Eleanor Rigby picking up the rice in the church. Yeah. For the Mamas and the Papas song, I think everyone has said California Dreamin', and everybody is incorrect. Yes. It is Monday, yeah. Monday.
Monday. Trust that day.
Can't trust that day.
They were thinking about a winter's day in California.
Right. Yeah, that's what I did too. Sure. But I just stopped thinking right there. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. For the Monkees song about a mode of transportation, Karen says Daydream Believer. I think Dana also wrote Daydream Believer. And Colin got it right with Last Train to Clarksville. The Last Train to Clarksville. Mm. And finally, the Beach Boys song that became the most expensive single ever produced at that point. Dana has said what?
I put Kokomo.
Kokomo from the Tom Cruise movie Cocktail in the '80s. Yeah. Karen put God Only Knows, and Colin put Wouldn't It Be Nice, the Beach Boys song, which famously became the most expensive song ever made at that time, was the instrument laden, incredibly complicated, psychedelic seminal hit "Good Vibrations" with the theremin. Just everything went like completely haywire with all of the instruments and the live animals in the studio and all that kind of stuff. But again, the point here being, Last Train to Clarksville, Monday, Eleanor Rigby, and Good Vibrations all lost rock song of the year to that thing we heard earlier. Yep.
Yeah.
In this very off topic quiz, you can all now tabulate your scores. Let's see if I don't think the asterisk comes into play.
This has got to be the worst quiz I've ever scored on.
I'm looking at 6 and then the asterisk point.
I got 5 asterisks. 5.
Okay, so the asterisk does not come into play. We don't need to worry about it.
Ooh. Forget that you guys just cheated and wrote other people's answer down.
They both did it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, and we have one last red colored segment. Colin?
I've got a segment for you guys called 1, 2, 3, Red Light. we passed a very important 100-year anniversary as a nation last year without any acknowledgement from us, certainly from me. I just found out about this. last year, 2021, it was the 100th anniversary of the modern traffic light. Okay. Yeah. Like, whoa, just sort of basically like what we would recognize today as like, yep, that's a traffic light. You know, now, of course, it's come a long way since then. It doesn't, you know, necessarily look as clunky, but the basic ideas of, fully automated, a four-way stop in the intersection, no involvement from a human. No, you don't need a person out there to either augment it or operate it in any way. All right, so get your barnyard buzzers ready here. I've got a few questions here for you. Got some trivia nuggets. We're going to kind of interleave them a little bit, loosely structured around a quiz. We'll kind of just do this lightning style here. So take your best guess, fire from the hip, get your buzzers ready. The first fully automated traffic light that I just described, traffic signaling system, was installed in what major U.S. city? Heard a cow. I believe that is Dana.
Is it New York City?
It is not New York City. I will say this is a city. Karen doesn't even need the hint I was going to offer. What do you got, Karen?
Oh, 1920s. Oh, no. I was going to guess L.A.
Oh, no, not L.A. Ooh, associated with traffic. I like what you're thinking. It is a city that does have a strong association with the automotive industry.
Oh, no. I guess. Yeah.
Chris.
How about Detroit, Michigan?
Detroit, yeah, Michigan. That is right. Yeah. It feels really appropriate to me. Yeah. That is sort of the home of the first fully automated, modern style traffic light.
Yeah. Motor City, right?
Motor City, that's right. Yeah. Motown. Karen's eyes just lit up like she just for the first time realized Motown.
It's Motor City.
Barry Gordy?
Yeah. Detroit.
Yeah.
The very same. Detroit sound. All right, traffic signaling. So, you know, what we look at as a traffic light, right? I mean, we think automobiles, but the history of sort of the meaning behind traffic signals goes back before cars to horse and buggies and to trains, really. So sort of agreed the first traffic light of any type, people will sort of say dates back to late 1860s in London. All right. Sort of what, you know, it was gas lit. It had red and green kind of semaphore style arms that would pop up, you know, and very directly influenced by train style signaling. A lot of sort of the, you know, a lot of sort of the language of how do you signal a moving vehicle at a distance, it kind of came directly from trains, right? So yeah, that was sort of the first traffic control device. It was not for cars, it was for horse carriages, really, and to sort of keep horses' carriages from running into each other and running over people and stuff like that. The lights were fueled by gas. It was very dangerous. It did explode at least one time. It was hazardous, but it did sort of start to codify red for stop, green for go in terms of traffic. All right. Well, red is deeply embedded in almost every culture as a sign of like just warning, danger, you know, hey, watch out. It is also physically the best wavelength for seeing over an extended distance. It really is the best one visually for our visual systems to kind of just grab our attention. So it also works for that, too. As time went on, you know, in America, the first electric traffic light was invented in 1912. But again, the crucial thing to note here was these were red and green only. And now you might think to yourself, okay, well, now what? There's a problem, which is how do you deal with changing abruptly from one color to the other, right? When, you know, like you're traveling fast. So the way that most of these systems would work is they would have a human, a person, a policeman there, or policewoman, a cop, standing there with a whistle. And as it was about to change from green back to red, they'd blow the whistle or, you know, wave a flag or something like that and signal to the drivers like, hey, you know, you got to slow down. It's about to change. In 1920, William Potts, he was a Detroit police officer. He eventually became the superintendent of signals. He invented the fully automated on a timer, which they had before, but they introduced the yellow light. This was his major contribution to the automated traffic signal. Is like they had the timing part down. They could have it, you know, change every 1 minute from red to green, but you still needed the person there to kind of monitor. And so yeah, William Potts, called Mr. Traffic Light. I mean, just this was huge, you know, advancement in the tech here. True or false? Some stoplights will change from red to green if you honk your horn at the intersection.
Oh,
Chris.
I bet
true.
What?
Not like because you're mad because it's taking so long. Because some stoplights are trying to detect if a car is there, right?
Like sensors. Mm-hmm. So, right.
If that sensor fails and you're waiting there, it's not going to go. But then if it hears a horn, it would be like, oh, I missed a car, and it would go. Like that's my headcanon. Yeah. So let's see if I'm right.
I was surprised to find out that this is, in fact, or I should say was true, that there was a generation of stoplights, of red lights, in America at least, after they were, you know, electrified and sort of semi-automated, at least on a timer, okay? But it was dumb. It wasn't smart in any sense. Like, even if there were no cars at the intersection, it just kept cycling through. So if you get stuck there, they did, in fact, have microphones that were able to pick up. If you honked your horn, it would change the signal and had a timer. So you couldn't do this every single time. It would time out for like 10 seconds and then go back again, right? You couldn't just sit there and it just never changes. Once they were able to figure out how to put like pressure plates in the thing, you know, in the street and things like that, and, you know, smarter sensors, they don't need the horn.
You know, the pressure plates don't recognize motorcycles sometimes.
And I ride my scooter around, and I was always told that too, and it seemed true to me too. I did read like that the newer generation of those the plates, basically, that they are a lot more sensitive.
Oh, it's sensor plates under the ground. It's sensor plates. I creep up a little bit further, and then that seems to trigger it. And I was like, maybe there's some sensor.
Yeah,
visually.
If you pull up, you'll see them. In fact, at many, if not most, intersections in a lot of big cities. And if you see like sort of a square with kind of cut off corners in the spot where the car would sit, and it looks like it's been like, if you imagine someone came in and cut like a cookie out and then resealed it. That's what those are. Is that underneath in that little loop, there's just a set of, you know, wired electrical receptors. And yeah, it picks up when you basically put enough pressure on. Yeah. As Karen said, some of the older ones, maybe a little more tuned to a car than a motorcycle. Yeah. Jump up and down really hard.
Yeah, that's what we do.
True or false? Some stoplights will change from red to green if you flash your high beams just right.
Ooh. False. I don't even know how to drive, and I think it's false. Seems really dangerous.
You know what? I'll go with true because, I mean, it's entirely possible that, like, they tried this too. You know,
yeah, or like police or fire engines or something.
This one is in fact blessedly false. Yeah.
Okay. Yay.
Okay. Now I should say though, there is a very, very tiny kernel of truth in this one, and I can sort of see how this one got out of sort of into a rumor. They did, in fact, have one or two types of special detectors for emergency vehicles. One is a sonic detection, but the other one can be light detecting, and very specifically tuned to the frequency of flashing of emergency lights or emergency vehicle lights. So you would have to, you know, it's the kind of thing like if you could flash your brights at like more than 12 times a second at exactly the right frequency, at exactly the right angle, maybe. But it is not, you're not going
to
be doing this.
Time humanly to go
possible.
Practice.
Yeah. No, yeah. In 2020, the city of Mumbai, India, ran trials of a red light system that does what when it detects excessive honking? Does what?
Okay. So there's a lot of people.
Uh-huh. It like blows bubbles out over the crowd to like remind you of the beauty of life.
Plays classical music.
Right. Does it just like go red for everybody?
It stays red longer. This was a
did it work?
So this was a trial program that the Mumbai police rolled out. One of many cities that suffers from noise pollution, and the idea was when the light changes, if it detects decibels over a certain level, it will add on more red time, and it has a flashing sign even to kind of like, you know, tell the people it's like honk more, wait more.
Oh my gosh!
They ran it for like 15-minute chunks a day at a few different intersections. It was really a control on noise pollution more than any kind of control on traffic. So no, it didn't go into permanent use.
This all just reminds me of before I took my driver's test. I was like watching YouTube videos, and I start watching this video, and the guy is like, "All right, now we're gonna change lanes. Now I'm gonna put on my signal." And as you can see, now that I've put on my turn signal, I look over my shoulder and the guy that's in the other lane over there, he's slowing down to let me in because he sees my signal. And I'm like, what? That doesn't make any sense. What? And I look at the YouTube video description, like, oh, he's in Canada.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just like, oh my God, I had to stop watching this video. It's like, this is going to get me killed.
Yeah. You need the American version, which is, I'm going to make this lane change. So I'll put my signal on when I'm 2/3 of the way done. So you can tell where I came from and just keep on driving. In 1980, as part of a national years-long fuel-saving effort, Massachusetts became the last state to allow drivers to do what?
Oh, traffic light.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah, I got it. It is. I have my buzzer. I just wanted to make the noise myself.
Okay.
Make a right on red.
You got it. Make a right on red. That's right. Yep. And the history behind this is really fascinating. I've lived in a couple really extreme places in my life when it comes to driving. I've lived in Los Angeles, learned to drive in Los Angeles, and I've also lived in New York City. So growing up in California, I was actually surprised to learn when I moved to New York that, oh, you cannot turn right on red in New York City. And I met a lot of New Yorkers who'd lived there their whole life who could not fathom a world that I described where you were allowed to turn right on red. Yeah. They're like, well, what's the point of the red light? You just turn right willy-nilly.
It's not just allowed to turn right on red. You will be honked at if you do not turn right on red.
That's right. Right. Sometimes even on the red arrow. Like I stumbled into this. If you can Google like, okay to turn right on red arrow, because there's so many people, it's just like, I get honked at the same intersection every time. It's like, no, you can't do that. We tried to make this as clear as possible. It was for a long time, the right on red was a Western states thing, predominantly. All the way up even through the 70s, even, it sounds like. It was just kind of a Western states thing. And, you know, just more open traffic, I guess, more open roads. And it was the fuel crisis that really started spurring a lot of states to amend their laws, their state Department of Transportation laws, to allow right on red. And the federal government, like they do with a lot of things, they use this funding, you know, carrot and withholding funding stick approach, which is if you want these federal highway funds, you have to basically change your state laws to kind of follow what we encourage and recommend. And so this was one of them. And so in the mid to late 70s, kind of just a wave of the states changing their laws. Massachusetts was the last one to finally remove the ban, you know, technically on turning right on red. And yeah, and basically, you know, the Fed said, we want you wherever possible to allow people to turn right on red. And it does in fact save fuel. I mean, certainly in cars of the 1970s, and yeah, cars have definitely gotten a lot better, and there's the smart shutoff or idling or things like that. But it did save fuel. It also produced a sharp increase in pedestrian-related accidents and fatalities.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's the American trade-off.
Really?
Yeah, who's to say?
Yeah.
But we saved some money.
Yeah. And so even today, so the state of things today is that most states never went back, never looked back.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, New York City is still, you know, the kind of the one major pocket in our country where just as a rule, you cannot turn right on red. You need to be specifically told that you can. All right, last one here. And not strictly on the red light, but we're in the traffic light family here. So first-time visitors might be surprised to see traffic lights with red, yellow, and blue in this country. Red, yellow, and blue. Chris Kohler, no surprise.
What's
the answer, Chris?
Well, here's the thing. I'm gonna say this, but then I'm gonna have something to say if I'm right. The answer is, are you going for Japan?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And what can you tell us about Japan, Chris? I don't want to have you do my segment for me, but as the native Japanese speaker.
Well, here's the thing. So yes, in Japan, when you say the colors on the stoplight, you say it's blue. It's called blue in Japan because it's sort of in the blue greenish area everywhere at all. So like you could call it blue or you could call it green. And it's really just a matter of like perception. Yeah.
So as I mentioned at the top of the segment here, you know, red is kind of just real fundamental culturally, right? I mean, but it's also fundamental biologically, right? I mean, you know, I was a psych student. I remember learning like the color and perception and culture research. And, you know, basically in a very broad summary, you know, cultures, if you develop two color terms, it's black and white or light and dark. If you have a culture that develops three color terms, it's black, white, and red. And I mean, like virtually always, it proceeds in this pattern. It's like if it goes from two to three, red is what you add. And then if it goes to four, you get black, white, or dark light, red, and then some sort of catch-all term for blue and green. And in a lot of cultures that have ancient, older languages, this still kind of persists, like this idea of blue and green sort of occupying the same color term. And I learned that the idea of a separate word for green is actually relatively recently added to the Japanese language,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
Kind of how like in English, you know, the distinction between red and orange was relatively new. Orange was just another shade of red, which is why we called redheads redheads, because, you know.
Oh!
Yeah, we just, when that term was kind of locked in,
right,
that was red to us, right, yeah.
Well,
the
Japanese word for the color orange is orenji, which means it's a foreign loan word. It was brought
and
so the concept had been brought in.
Right, right. Hmm. So here's what gets really interesting. Okay, so there is, like everything else in the world, right, there's an international treaty or convention or, you know, something on traffic signs, road signals, everything. There is, in fact, the Vienna Convention on Road Signs and Signals. And the goal was to standardize across the world, what's kind of the language of traffic signals and things like that? And some of the things that they codify are stop is red, caution is yellow or amber, green is go, things like that. And so as these policies and conventions and things got more and more widespread around the world, countries were kind of doing their best to sort of fit the system. So in Japan, all right, this is absolutely true. In 1973, the Japanese government, there was a cabinet order that traffic lights use the bluest shade of green possible. So they're like, they task their crews, like, we want you to find something that is still technically green, but is as blue as possible, we call that color ao in Japanese, right? Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to have people have this disconnect between the color and the label that they had already given it. So if you ask, you know, the Japanese government, they'll say, oh, yeah, these are green. Yeah, green. These are totally green. Yeah. But internally, it's like, you know, they're greenish bluish. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for going down the road with me there, stopping occasionally, starting again and turning right on red a few times and learning a little bit about traffic lights and the red one in particular.
Woo!
Yeah, interesting.
And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about cherries, Taylor Swift's red, red, and traffic lights. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on all podcast apps, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, The Accidental Creative, and I Know What Scares You. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
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 Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.